that two?
Four.
No.
Okay.
So, over the weekend, my mind got erased, and I'm sure that many of you too, maybe for a different reason, party and all that. So I'll start with a quick review. And then I'll really complete my fourth lecture, and then my sixth lecture will be what would have been the fifth. Just very, very quick review. So we started from some cosmic situation, which I'm told should not be called cosmic, but I still don't know what the correct name is. So you count cosmic coincidences, which you can build using chopsticks on top of a knot. This gives you a pairing of diagrams with knots. You make a generating function out of this pairing. So for every knot, you sum over all diagrams the diagram itself times its pairing with the knot times uninteresting combinatorial factors, and the result is a big linear combination of diagrams. And then the statement was that modulo certain relations, this generating function z of k is a knot invariant. The relations were, and it's not at all an obvious theorem that these are all the relations, and I in fact only indicated one of them. But anyway, the relations are the so-called IHX relation and STU relations, again, discussed a while ago. Then we started looking for what does it mean, and the first answer was it comes from physics. So it all comes from perturbative quantum, from perturbative Chern-Simons-Witten theory. So you write a certain big path integral, and then you expand it in terms of Feynman diagrams, and the Feynman diagrams that arise turn out to be exactly the same kind of Feynman diagrams, or the same kind of diagrams that occur in the summation that made up Z. The Feynman integrals themselves, well, all I did was I very, very vaguely described how general principles of Gaussian integration tell you that the Feynman diagrams would always be a sum over graphs that are made out of like pieces that look like the inverse quadratic form and the polynomial interaction. And in our case, I argued that they look that those graphs that you get are the same graphs as the graphs that appeared in the Stonehenge story. However, when you actually do the details and you find out what Q inverse and what P and what all of these parts are, it turns out that the Feynman integrals that you get precisely evaluate this Stonehenge pairing. So indeed, these two invariants are the same. Anyway, the next thing we did was we looked for a topological significance to that, and I said that it actually has an extremely simple topological significance. Namely, there is a very extremely natural notion of a polynomial invariant on the space of knots. Again, not to be confused with an invariant of knots whose values are polynomials. It's something else. It's a single function of the space of knots, which should be thought of as a polynomial. Okay? And the claim was that C was somehow the universal such invariant. Okay? So, more precisely, we said, well, given any knot diagram with a number of marked crossings, let's call this the double points, you can resolve the double points by declaring that a double point is equal to an overcrossing minus an undercrossing. So if you have like four of them, it becomes a sum of 16 of 16 knots with coefficients, and then we say that an invariant is of type 3 if it vanishes whenever such a whenever its extension to four vertices, to four such double points, vanishes. So, or in general, if it is of type M, if whenever you extend it to knots with M plus 1 vertices, double points, you get 0. So it's like a polynomial. Something is of degree M if its M plus first derivative is equal to 0. Well, the immediate conjecture to make is that finite type invariants are as good as polynomials. So they separate knots. And it remains a conjecture. It's been open for about 20 years now, maybe more, but it's still open. Furthermore, no real progress has been made. Maybe I should say that there are similar circumstances in which this conjecture has been proven, but there are also similar circumstances in which the analog conjecture has been disproven. So it's not going to be an easy statement. Anyway, the next claim was that there are actually lots of finite type invariants. So far we didn't even, it wasn't even clear that there is a single one. Okay? But the claim is that there are many, and the typical way to get them is to take something like the Conway polynomial, C of K, or the Jones polynomial or some other non-polynomial, and expand it as a power series, and then every individual coefficient turns out to be in itself a polynomial on the space of knots. Okay. The next thing we did was we said, okay, so finite type invariants appear to be valuable. Let's try to classify all of them. Let's try to find all of them. And we said, let's look at the nth derivative, the mth derivative of an invariant of type M. And we argued that it should be viewed, we argued that it should be viewed as a functional on core diagrams. And furthermore, that functional, by some nice Lasso argument, you may remember, maybe just for the reminder, I'll draw it. By some nice Lasso argument, this is equal to to that. We found that the linear functional on core diagrams that we got must satisfy the 4T relation. And finally, I sketched why the space of core diagrams modulo 4T relations is in fact equivalent, is isomorphic, to the space A of the previous few slides. So the space of those trivalent graphs modulo IHX and STO relations. And then we stated that the fundamental theorem holds, namely, every linear functional on A comes from a finite type invariant if and only if there exists an expansion, and an expansion or a so-called universal finite type invariant. An expansion is a Z going from K to core diagrams, such that if K is n singular, then Z of K is, well, if K is n singular, it has an underlying core diagram, then Z of K is D of K plus higher order terms. Okay? And then the point was that Z that was constructed before solves exactly this problem. Hence, its topological significance is that it contains in it, it precisely contains in it the all the information there is in all finite type invariants taken at once. Okay, and then I
moved on and said, let's look for the significance of our picture in algebra. And again, let me remind you the overall big picture of the relationship of this story with algebra. So there is a map K to A from topology to combinatorics. And later, I will be talking about other types of topology, and there will be a different type of diagrams corresponding to it. But at the moment, K is knots, and I'm adding etc. because in a minute I will reintroduce knotted trivalent graphs and other objects that look a lot like knots. Okay? So, and A is core diagrams, and again, at this very second, core diagrams still means core diagrams with skeleton, a single circle, but in a few minutes it will mean again core diagrams with more complicated skeleta. So that's topology and combinatorics. And then it turns out that there is something that I call Lie algebra, which is the following. If you choose a Lie algebra, you can map this space A into the universal enveloping algebra of this Lie algebra. So A is somehow a space of universal formulas which have a meaning in the universal enveloping algebra of every Lie algebra. So in some sense, it's a universal enveloping algebra. And then there is also high algebra. And high algebra is most of what I want to talk about today, or high algebra in the context of knot theory, because there are other contexts as well. So high algebra is the following. Let's try to construct Z by algebraic means. So let's look for a presentation of the space K. So let's somehow write K as a space generated by finitely many things, modulo finitely many relations, and let's not look just for a Z which satisfies the property of before, but also a Z that will intertwine all the allowed operations, so it will be somehow multiplicative or homomorphic, so it will map the product of things here to the corresponding product of things here. If we're looking for such a Z, then it is enough to define it on the generators of K so that it will solve the relations in K. And that's a matter of solving finitely many equations in finitely many unknowns. And, you know, it could be easy or could be hard. As it turns out in our case, it's hard enough and significant enough that I think it should be called, again, in this context, high algebra. Okay? Anyway, a quick reminder of what Lie algebra was. So if you had A on a skeleton which had, say, several skeleton lines, it would map into the universal enveloping algebra raised to the tensor power equal to the number of skeleton lines, 2 in this case. And the map was actually rather simple. If you had a core diagram on this skeleton, you simply label its chords with lowercase Spanish letters, A, B, C, D. Surely it's pronounced differently in Spanish. I mean, these are dummy variables anyway, so they could have been Hebrew letters. Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Daled. And then use sum over, or Arabic, or whatever, sorry. Anyway. So, and then you sum over all of these variables the following expression. So for every internal vertex, you take the structure constants at that vertex. So if it's surrounded by ABC, you'll take FABC. And then you read the word that you see along each of the skeleton lines and make it a word in the universal enveloping algebra. So the word you read around along the top here is ADC. Yes. So you take XA, XD, XC, where this is a set of orthonormal generators for the Lie algebra you started from.
And one other point about operations. So there are natural operations on the space of knots with several components, or more precisely on the space of tangles. So knots that go from minus infinity to infinity, sort of several knotted strings that go from minus infinity to infinity. Anyway, there are several operations, there is a natural operations on such knots, and this is the doubling operation, drawn schematically here, and I think it's clear how it would work in general. This operation induces an operation on the nth derivative of on nth derivatives. Okay? And so by double duality, it induces an operation on core diagrams. And I marked it schematically here. If you have a core diagram on a skeleton which is a single component, you get a core diagram on a skeleton which is two components by summing over all possible ways of lifting the legs of this diagram from the one skeleton component to the two skeleton components that you get here. And finally, once you have chosen a Lie algebra, this becomes an operation on the universal enveloping algebra of that Lie algebra, and in fact, it's the coproduct. Okay? And then a homomorphic expansion would be a map from some space of knots, which is an expansion, meaning it satisfies the condition of a few slides ago, but which also intertwines all the relevant algebraic operations. So, had we been talking about tangles, the equations that a homomorphic expansion would have to satisfy would be that Z of this, if you take its, so you get a linear combination of things here, if you take its delta, you get a linear combination of things here, would be the same as if you first take delta and then compute Z. Okay. However, as it turns out, there is no homomorphic expansion for tangles. And it's a different issue how to prove that, but since the answer at the end is no, we have to move somewhere else. And here is the first somewhere else in which you get a positive answer. So we wish to extend everything to knotted trivalent graphs. And let me remind you that when I talk about knotted trivalent graphs, I actually mean knotted trivalent ribbon graphs. So each edge is not quite a one-dimensional thing, but a thin two-dimensional band. But again, it's not really different than ordinary knot theory, or it's different by only a tiny amount, because the only thing that a thin band can do more than a strand is to twist around itself a number of times. So the only difference between knotted thin bands and knotted strands is an integer parameter for each edge. Okay? Anyway, and otherwise, here are a few examples of knotted trivalent graphs. There is a corresponding space of core diagrams. The corresponding space of core diagrams would look like the following. Well, you would take
the blue ones too.
Matthias, how did you do it so that you could actually write? The blue ones, okay. So now the blue represents the skeleton. So, you know, if we're talking about a knotted tetrahedron, here is the skeleton, and a core diagram for this would be take the skeleton and put on top of it another trivalent graph, okay? And then mod out by the same STU and IHX relation as before, but there is a new relation which comes from lasso in the vertex. And this new relation is that the sum of all three ways of ending a chord near a vertex, so So, you know, if you end it south of the vertex, or northeast of the vertex, or northwest of the vertex, the sum of all these three ways is equal to zero. Okay. Okay, the point, you see, we switched to algebra, so it's no longer enough to talk about spaces of knots. Okay, I actually want these spaces to have some algebraic structure, so that I can compose them, so that I can talk about this space of knots being finitely generated or finitely presented. Okay? So, what are the operations on knotted trivalent graphs? And I mentioned it last time already. Well, there are two unary operations and one or two binary operations. The unary operation, or in fact, it's not quite a single unary, it's not two, it's two families. I'll explain that in a minute. So, the unary operations go as follows. If you have a knotted trivalent graph, which locally has a picture that looks like this, and again, this is a schematic drawing, so in fact, everything here could be highly knotted, then you could take the middle edge and either forget it or delete it, so it's the D operation, or unzip it, so that's the U operation, and unzip is parallel to the delta operation, that, or similar to the delta operation that we had before. Anyway, the reason it's not unary operations, or a single unary operation, but a family of unary operations, is because these operations also depend on, you have to point at an edge and say, let's unzip this edge. Okay? So, it depends also on singling out an edge. Okay? It's a little more than a single unary operation. Likewise, there is a final family of binary operations, which again depends on, choosing a pair of edges. So if you have two knotted trivalent graphs and you choose an edge here and an edge here, you can embed these two knotted graphs far, far, far away from each other, and then connect them by a long strand that crosses this wall between them only once, this sort of long distance between them only once, and which connects the edge you've chosen on the left to the edge you've chosen on the right. And last time I mentioned that there is a second family of binary operations, which is the vertex connect sum, but in fact it's a little exercise to show that this operation can be written in terms of that operation and two unzips. Okay, let me do it, it's so easy. Right, if you unzip this, you'll get, well, this will become a two-lane highway, and then you unzip one of these lanes once again, and you'll get the three-line highway going that way. Okay? So really, there are only three operations. Okay? Or three families of operations. Anyway, the claim is that with these operations, knotted trivalent graphs are generated by only two elements. Okay? So if you are allowed to do these operations, knotted trivalent graphs are generated by only two things, and therefore if you wanted to define an invariant on knotted trivalent graphs, which would be well behaved under these operations, all you need to know is the value of this invariant on these two generators. Now, what are these two generators? One of those is ribbon twists, and unfortunately I didn't make a picture of the ribbon twist here. So let me make a picture on the blackboard. Well, the ribbon twist is really a ribbon with a twist on it. So take an unknotted, again, this is now a generator of the space of knotted trivalent graphs. So it better be an individual single knotted trivalent graph. The one I'm taking is, take a ribbon, just a circular ribbon, and put a single twist in it. Okay? What is it called? The Möbius span. So it's really the Möbius span.
Möbius.
Möbius?
Möbius.
Ah, I don't know. and then the set. Maybe I should say that with this generator, once you have this generator, you no longer have to worry about bands, about the fact that the edges of not a turbulent graph are actually bands. Why? Because, you know, suppose you had some crazy not a turbulent graph having no imagination whatsoever. Here is my crazy not a turbulent graph. Suppose I wanted to add a twist to one of the suppose I wanted to twist one of its bands once more. Okay? The claim is that I can do it using this generator and the operations I have. So how would I do it? Well, I'd take my ribbon twist element, put it here. Here it is. Okay? I'll take its connect sum with this crazy knot that I have here. Here is the connect sum. Then I'll unzip along the connect sum edge. So I'll get this picture. And what I have here now, topologically, is exactly what I had before, with an extra twist on one of the edges. So once I have this element, I don't have to worry about twisting the edges anymore. Anyway, claim, given those ribbon twists, everything is generated by the operations that I have and the tetrahedron. And the proof is a Vietnam-era proof. Unfortunately, I didn't make it as individual slides, so I'll just have to sort of scroll. So this is the communist plan to take over the world. Okay, the domino theory. You may, so the way the Americans used to see it. Okay, you overthrow the government of one country in Southeast Asia. You plant agent. You overthrow the country in the government of one country in Southeast Asia. And once this is done, we'll use it as a basis to overthrow the government of the neighboring country, let's call it Cambodia. This done, you go over and take over Laos, and at the end, you rule the world. Okay? So, so you take your original knot, okay, this is the trefoil, this is the one we want to generate, this is the one we want to conquer somewhere, somehow. So I write it in blue, because first of all, it still belongs to the blues. And secondly, it's the blueprint, it's still the blueprint for my plan for taking over the world. The next step is that I plant agents. My agents are little tetrahedra embedded in R3 independently of each other, far away from each other. Okay? And each one is embedded in the way shown, so right on top of the vertex, so that, well, two of the edges follow the edges of the crossing, and the other four kind of make a nice defensive cell around it. Okay? So these are this is the plant agents phase. Okay? Notice, sorry, now I'm skipping back from politics into mathematics. Notice that I've used ribbon twists here, and that's in fact the only place where I would use ribbon twists. Because in fact, these tetrahedra are not the same as the ordinary tetrahedron that I had before, this one. Namely, if you think of each of these edges as tiny, thin ribbons, this is in fact not the same as that one. You see, I mean, in order to make this one look like this one, you'll have to take the middle ribbon and pull it out. And when you pull it out, it gets twisted. So in fact, these two differ by a small number of ribbon twists, but we already know how to manage ribbon twists, so we're not worried. Okay? Anyway, back to our take over the world scheme. So after we've planted agents in the key points, we connect them. We connect them using the vertex connect sum operation. Okay? So we choose, say, this one to be the main one, and we connect it with a vertex connect sum to here, and then with a vertex connect sum to there. By the way, I wish I could continue and make a vertex connect sum along here. You'll see in a minute why I would have wished to do that. But I can't. I can't because this is not one of my allowed operations. I never had an operation which allowed me to take an existing knotted Trevelyan graph and add an edge to it. Okay? And the reason I never had this operation is because this operation is not well defined. Right? If I have a knot already, and I want to add an edge to it somewhere, so I want to let's pretend I have a knot. Okay, so I have a knot, and I want to add an edge from here to here. It's not enough that I tell you add an edge from here to here. I would have to tell you how it is embedded in R3. So just adding an edge is not a well-defined operation. However, adding an edge between two disconnected things is a well-defined operation. So I could connect all my agents to form a tree, but once they are a tree, I cannot make any further connections.
So you're making choices then?
Yeah, I made a choice. The choice was in which maximal tree I should choose among my network of potential network of agents. Okay? Now, take over the first country. So, sorry, what I mean by take over the first country is, well, I cannot do a vertex connect sum here, but I can take this edge. Topologically, it goes this way, but you see, I can just slide it to go that way. Topologically, it's an equivalent picture. So this would mean like taking over the central country. Okay? So I've taken over the central... Oops, sorry, I should have gone further to the left. So I've taken over the central country. And this is a part of my scheme, and now I'm ready to continue my domino theory. So I'll unzip this edge. Here you go, that's what I get. And now I'm ready to take over the next country by sliding this red edge across it, and I may as well take over the several neighboring countries as well. So I'll take over this one and that one, and the result is this picture. Okay? And finally, let me unzip this little edge, and that little edge. And if you look at the result, it is just the original knot that I wanted to achieve, surrounded by an extra circle. And then I have this forget operation, so use it, and you're left with the circle with the knot you started from. Okay? So again, the process was I had a blue picture which I wanted to represent in terms of generators, and what I did was to show you how to represent it in terms of generators. First of all, put a generator at each vertex, then apply one type of operations along a maximal tree, then use then alternate using isotopies, which is legal because I'm always talking about invariants. So alternate using isotopies and unzips until you come essentially to the picture you wanted. And, yes?
So in this case, the end product doesn't depend on your choices. Is it always
sure?
Well, in this case, I'm aiming to show you how to get to the trefoil using my operations, okay? Sort of by definition, I'll always get to the trefoil. Right, I'm describing the sequence of operations that will always get you to the trefoil.
So, particular.
Yeah. But you see, it's clear that what I did was general. Suppose I wanted to take over a more complicated blue universe. Okay, so I don't know, let me draw a slightly more complicated blue universe. So, given my lack of talent, it will be, it will be the trefoil with, say, a few edges added. Okay? So again, suppose I wanted to write this graph as a product of generators. What I would do is, first of all, I would plant agents in all of the vertices. So near the crossings, I would do like I did before. So I would put a little tetrahedron on each vertex. And now let me do it a little less cleanly, but more quickly. Okay?
Maybe so that I'm such an idiot.
Yeah.
Like first, I didn't understand this driven. This second, I don't understand why this tetrahedron is not the same one as the one I first. Is it directing graphs or something?
No. So when I draw it, okay, so.
To me, this tetrahedron is the same as this one.
So you actually lose very little by thinking that they are the same. So, they're different in the sense that really all graphs that I'm talking about are ribbon graphs. So, when I draw a tetrahedron, well, I draw it like this, but I really mean that each of the edges is a thin ribbon. So, this okay, this graph is really this graph. Okay, and each of these is like a thin ribbon. Okay, and likewise, this tetrahedron, okay, is really, oh my god. You know, I really have, part of the reason I prepare stuff in advance is because my ability to draw in real time is absolutely limited. Okay, so by this I mean this ribbon picture. Okay? Now these two are the same as graphs, but these two are not the same as topological spaces, or as ribbon graphs, if you wish. Because you see, well, here are two ways to see it.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you mean by the Mendes bundles, so it's sort of separate dimensions.
Okay, I mean, but let me repeat it anyway since I started.
if you wanted to demonstrate that this is equal to that, or if you wanted to demonstrate that this is equal to that, what you'd have to do is you'd have to pull this edge outside. If you pull it outside, you'll get kind of, oh wow, you'll get, no, it's not this one that you want to pull out, it's the other one, not that it really matters. You'll get this box, and this is just the same as that, but by just a planar deformation, okay? However, if you try to pull this ribbon out, you will find that, well, it comes out from the wrong side of the vertex, kind of from here, so you have to twist it out, and you have to twist that one out too, and that just, that will end up adding twists on four of the edges, okay? So, but again, since I already know how to deal with twisting edges, these two are not quite the same generators, but they're closely related. They differ only by this modulus term. Okay? Anyway, so back to the domino theory, suppose I wanted to conquer this world, this universe, I'd plant agents, at the crossings, then I'd plant further agents at the vertices, and those agents at the vertices would in fact be ordinary tetrahedra. So I'd replace, basically I'd draw a little circle around each vertex and then complete it to a tetrahedron. Okay? Then I would choose a maximal tree and do vertex connect sums. So this will become a vertex connect sum. This will become a vertex connect sum, and so on for all of them. And then I'll take over the states one by one using the same procedure. At the end of the story, all the blue turned red. So blue is what I wanted to take over, and red is what I can write in terms of the generators and operators. So if all blue turned red, I've achieved what I wanted. No, it's not that I couldn't unzip. Once I've connected, okay, once these two are on the same, once this one and that one are on the same connected component, I can no longer add edges in between these two because this is not a topologically well-defined operation. It's not one of my operations. Okay? However, I have a substitute. And the substitute is to slide this edge. Okay, so this edge goes away from here and now goes here, and now I can unzip. And I'm ready to continue the procedure. No, at the end, no. At the end, I get I gave you a schematics how to get the trefoil, or this particular non-trivialent graph, and it will always get this one. Okay. Anyway, so. If it wasn't for the ribbons, no, in fact. You see, in order for the unzip to make sense, the edge along which you unzip must itself have some thickness. Okay. Otherwise, you can't cut it in the middle. Or more precisely, you know, if you try to cut a hair along the middle, you'll never know if you've, or, you know, if you have a one-dimensional object, you never know if you, well, sort of when you double it, you never know if you've doubled it right or if the double thing had gone around it several times. Okay, so it's not topologically well defined to double a single line. Okay, however, it is topologically well-defined to cut a ribbon in the middle. Okay? Anyway, so I've proven that the non-tetravalent graphs are finitely generated. They're generated by the tetrahedra and by the ribbon twists. Well, but there are also relations. Okay? And it's not terribly difficult to classify all the relations. Basically, what you have to do is to figure out, one thing, there are several places where relations come from, but the primary one is the following. You see, I want the end result to be an invariant of knots. Okay? So, but something which is an invariant of knots should be invariant under the Rademeister rules. So, it should satisfy that when you compute it on this, you should get the same answer as when you compute it on. As when you compute it on that. Okay? So you run this domino theory algorithm on this and on that, and you find that they give you, that this algorithm gives you a different product of tetrahedra for each side. So the value of the tetrahedron, whatever it is, must satisfy this relation that is forced by this is equal to that. So you enumerate all of these relations, and there are a small number, okay? And the most interesting of which is the relation that I'm showing here, okay? The relation which I'm showing here, it's a sort of very, it's a famous relation in mathematics. It occurs in many places. But let me first of all show you what it is, and then remind you where else it occurs. So take three tetrahedra, make their vertex connect sum along these two vertices, and you get the picture drawn here. Well, push this line down and unzip it. You'll get the picture drawn here. And the picture drawn here is, if you look at it, it's a triangular prism looked at from above. Okay? So it's, you see here is the base, and here is the top, and here are the three edges, the three sides. But I could have also gotten a triangular prism in a different way from two tetrahedra. So take two tetrahedra and simply make their connected sum. Take their vertex connected sum. And you get, again, a triangular prism. So this is a 3 equals 2 relation. It's a relation that says that three tetrahedra connected in a certain way give the same answer as two tetrahedra connected in a different way. Okay? Now, here's a sort of picture way of doing it, and maybe the most famous way of seeing it is dually. So if you look at the dual of this picture, it becomes putting three tetrahedra, or merging, or taking the union of three tetrahedra along their faces in a certain way is equal to taking the union of two tetrahedra along their faces in some other way. And this is sort of a famous move in combinatorial topology. It's the so-called Pachner move that allows you to go from one triangulation of a three-manifold to any other triangulation of that three-manifold. So, in one word, that's the origin of this relation, the topological origin of this relation. Anyway, the claim is that if you call phi, if you let the value of the tetrahedron be called phi, then this relation
becomes the so-called Greenfield pentagon of the theory of quasi-Hopf algebras. So I guess I have to do a little bit of a break and tell you about what is an associator and what is the Greenfield or what is the well and what is the pentagon equation. So I have to do it very, very quickly. And roughly here it is. So Greenfield considered the following issue. And again, I'm probably not doing justice to him. Okay? So if you look at the representations of a certain Lie algebra, they form a so-called monoidal category, or a tensor category, if you wish, which means that you can take the tensor product of any two representations, and that's again a representation. Now, the tensor product in general is an associative operation. So, if you look, so over here, since all multiplications are really tensor products, I've omitted the tensor products. So, if you look at the tensor product of representation A with representation B and then tensor it with representation C, it's the same as the tensor product of B and C tensored with A. Greenfield said, let's try to deform this. Let's try to look for alternative, let me say it differently. The fact that these two are isomorphic means that there is an isomorphism between them, means that there is a map between them, well, which identifies this with that. And Greenfield says, let's look for situations, or let's try to invent situations in which the map between these is non-trivial. So instead of this being somehow obviously equal to that, let's look for a non-obvious isomorphism going from A tensor B tensor C to A tensor B tensor C. Okay? But he wanted a condition, and the condition he wanted, and again there are very good reasons for that, but that's not the right time to state them. The condition he wanted was that if by a strange sequence of associativities, you start from one object, do this sequence of associativities, and come back to the same object, well, if you compose all those isomorphisms that you get on the way, you wanted the composition to be one. You wanted to come back to where you started. Okay? So here is the simplest such chain of isomorphisms that you could write. So look at the object A times B times C, sorry, A tensor B tensor C tensor D. You can reassociate ABC to become A tensor B tensor C tensor D. Then you can think of BC as being a single object, because after all, the tensor product of two things is a single object, which is just bigger. Okay? So you could think of this object as a bigger object and reassociate it to the right so that you get this picture. Over here you have BC taken together. You could have reassociated it to the right so as to get this picture, so as to get this tensor product. But you could have come to this tensor product in another way, and the other way is to think of A and B as a block and reassociate it to the right so that you get this. And then think of CD as a single block and reassociate it to the, I forgot which side is right and which side is left, but anyway, reassociate it to get this. Okay? So we got two isomorphisms between this object and that object, which means that if we take this one composed with that one inverse, we will have come from this object to itself, and we want this product to be one. So this is this Greenfield pentagon equation. And again, it doesn't look fundamental, but it is. Okay, it looks like a bizarre equation that one writes for no obvious reason. And it isn't. Okay? So now let's go back to the context of representation theory. In general, how would you write a map from this, from the tensor product of three things to the tensor product of three things, well, you one way to do it is to take an element in the universal enveloping algebra. Remember that elements of the universal enveloping algebra act on representations. Okay? So if you want to act on three representations, you need an element in the third tensor power of the universal enveloping algebra. So if you want a map from ABC to ABC, you need an element phi in the third tensor power of your universal enveloping algebra. And then, again, assuming, well, assuming various nice properties that I'm not stating, basically you have to figure out how, what the isomorphism would be for each of the edges of this tetrahedron. And the rules are rather simple, and there is a rather easy way to get to them. But roughly, well, over this edge, D stays in place. So the element of the universal enveloping algebra of four things, so the element of U of G tensor to the fourth, that would take you from here to here, should be this phi that we had here, tensored with one, or with one added on the last component, because we're not touching D. Over here, we're considering BC as a block. So sort of we want the middle tensor factor of phi to act on both B and C, and the way the universal enveloping algebra acts on a tensor product is via the coproduct. So the element that should be appearing here is 1 tensor delta tensor 1 of phi. Okay? And likewise, you can interpret or rewrite all of these edges using phi, and you come to the pentagon equation written over here, and this is the so-called Drinfeld pentagon equation. And I should say that there is a similar equation called the hexagon, which I'm not bothering to show you, but it comes from a very similar picture in which you have six things along around this, a hexagon instead of just five around the pentagon. Okay. Anyway, now I have to tell you how to make the correspondence between the non-theoretic picture and this Drinfeld picture. So the first thing to say is that in some sense I didn't quite lie to you, but I falsely advertised something. So you see, the theory of knotted trivalent graphs is actually a lot simpler than you think. Okay? And the reason is the following. If you have a knotted trivalent graph, well, take the one that was written here in blue before, you can always choose a maximal tree in it, and a maximal tree, a tree topologically, is just a point. So you can contract this maximal tree to a point, and what you will have left will be a thick point. And out of this thick point, various edges come in and come right back out. Or come go out and come back in. Okay? So really,
the maximal, you mean the spanning tree.
What?
The spanning tree.
A maximal tree, yeah, it's a spanning tree. So if you contract a spanning tree to a point, all you have left is the knotting of, a single sort of bouquet of edges. Okay? So really, a knotted trivalent graph is simply a knotting of a bouquet
with a little bit of further combinatorial information, which is sort of the graph that has been contracted to nearly a point over here. Okay? So, in particular, if you start from the tetrahedron, a knotting of a tetrahedron, so any knotting of a tetrahedron, or there is a, once you choose a maximal tree, there is a bijection between knotting of a tetrahedron and knotting of a bouquet. And the next thing you can do is you can sort of invert at this point. And then knotting at a bouquet of a bouquet is the same as knottings of three parallel edges. Okay? So likewise, the space of chord diagrams along a tetrahedron can be reduced to the space of chord diagrams along just three edges of the tetrahedron. Somehow you can, using the relations we have, you can clear the edges of a maximal tree, and all of the remaining chords connect only three edges. And you therefore only have a chord diagram on three edges, which is the space of universal formulas for elements in the universal enveloping algebra tensored three times. And once again, I ran out of time. I probably have to skip the rest, but that was the beginning of the bijection. Phi, which was the invariant of the tetrahedron, can be reinterpreted as a universal formula for an element in the universal enveloping algebra tensor cubed. And then when you read the equation that I had before and translate it to an equation in A of three strands, it becomes exactly the Drinfeld pentagon equation. And I think I'll stop here.
You're using the standard book, right?
Yes.
So this is a standard pentagon equation.
Yes.
Is it Kosakoff? Kosakoff is...
No, the standard pentagon equation is an equation for the for a quasi-Hopf algebra. You see, in a Hopf algebra, co-associativity holds as inequality. In a quasi-Hopf algebra, it holds with sort of phis. So the pentagon equation is an equation... The standard pentagon is an equation for a quasi-Hopf algebra.
So the Lie algebra coproduct has changed here?
No, everything, I've never used any deformed coproduct of any kind. The coproduct is always the standard coproduct.
That's co-associative.
That is co-associative, but I'm writing a strange equation which uses it. I mean, the equation uses the standard coproduct, but it's not the co-associativity of the coproduct. It's a different equation. Sorry. Why is because I ran out of time, so I did it too quickly. But the basic point is that you only have to knot three lines, and it turns out that it's sort of what the configuration of their endpoint matters very little, as it turns out. But again, I said it too quickly.
Yeah, why not? Why does the set of functions and the inputs associated with the problem?
That comes from a completely different story. So, you know, so far I'm telling you what this equation means, what the pentagon equation means, or what it means in topology. I'm not telling you how to solve it. One way to solve it was using these Stonehenge stories, okay? Or using Chern-Simons theory. Another way to solve the pentagon equation is using the Knishnik-Zhomological connection equation. And when you write down that solution in full, well, it becomes a certain iterated integral which can be reevaluated in terms of multiple zeta numbers, and so you get a phi whose coefficients are multiple zeta numbers. But you see, in some sense, you get the satisfaction that you wrote a closed form formula. In another sense, it's a useless formula because you understand multiple zeta numbers. So you cannot work with this formula. There is nothing you can do with it. Which amounts to saying that nobody understands multiple zeta numbers. There is a whole industry of producing conjectures and partially proving them. Anyway, okay, let me be more precise. Okay, let me be... No. In practice, it does not allow you to make any of the computations that you might want to make. In practice, the distance between that theory that's around and computing the invariant of the trefoil is infinity. Sort of what's known about multiple zeta numbers is so insufficient that it's practically useless for these purposes. Again, you have to set the goal. You have to know what you want. Okay? You know, if I want to compute the invariant of the trefoil, and again, you have to define what to compute means. Okay? If I want to be able to... I can be precise about what I mean by doing useful things. Okay? And you cannot do anything useful with these formulas. They're too far from what you need. Somehow, the whole fact that there is a whole theory around multiple zeta numbers is a proof that they're not understood. It's a theory whose main content is lots of conjectures. Other classes of knots, so it would be two-dimensional knots in R4, and what type of algebra they correspond to, and sort of it begins with some very, very nice pictures of what two-dimensional knots in R4 are, and then it becomes very complicated algebra. Or I could give a completely independent talk, completely unrelated, not mathematical physics, about something very beautiful with lots of nice pictures. The so-called Kolmogorov solution of Hilbert 13th problem, and the only value of it is its beauty. Okay? So I am sort of taking on myself a commitment to beauty, and I will not... But anyway, that's the second possibility. And the third possibility is you can fire me and say, we've heard enough of you, and let somebody else speak. So maybe you shouldn't answer me now, but between now and tomorrow, between now and this evening, you should tell the organizers so that I'm ready for my job tomorrow. And I'd be glad, with absolutely glad, with either possibility. Okay? Thank you very much.